Okay, today South Indian Shaiva Bhakti, Tamil 9 Mass. I mainly drew from the poems translated from, by Prentice, Karen Petulis. I couldn't get hold of Indira Peterson's translation poems to Shiva, which is an earlier this thing, which has the complete collection. But let's see. I think reading some of the questions that Karen Petulis Prentice, I think. Prentice is her husband's name, I think. Petulis is the maiden name. She raises questions about the notion that bhakti was started in the south and spread to North India. Now, the basic text to corroborate this is the one used is the Bhagavat Mahatmya. Chapter 148. So she suggests that the story of this text tells not the story of bhakti in general, but specifically Krishna bhakti. Now, of course, there is a larger debate whether or not Bhagavata Purana in general and the Alvar bhakti in particular is a Krishna bhakti or Vaishnava bhakti, you know, that debate is at the back of all this. The text that is referred to not only endorses a specific place, bhakti, text, deity, and so on, but also is actively polemical against places like Gujarat and what happens elsewhere and so on. So she says it is not appropriate to use this text as an unbiased history of bhakti. In other words, you can't use this text to kind of somehow trace the origins of bhakti and its development. One finds these in the biographical texts of the bhakti leaders. In other words, one has to read the various hagiographical biographical texts. There's some repairs going on here. But anyway, forget about that noise that we often get here. Is it open? Maybe that's why we're getting it. Yeah, that helps. Even these so-called hagiographical, biographical narratives, you have to read between the lines to kind of see what is historical account and what is legendary, mythological, or, you know, written in a retrospective manner. So she suggests from these biographical texts, we get a sense of movement by bhaktas in and among various regions, but we do not get the sense of a movement, meaning a unified agitation for reform. Again, in my earlier sessions, I talked about this whole issue of whether bhakti is a reaction to some kind of social, world as an attempt to reform, etc. And in that sense, seeing this whole bhakti as a single, unified, monolithic kind of movement throughout India. But I think scholars are more and more becoming convinced about the regional aspects of these bhakti movements that seem to differ, both in the the reasons why they arose and so on, but also in the very nature of their expressions and their particular historical and social and cultural backgrounds. So I think there is a great deal of diversity in the bhakti tradition. But of course, at some level, we have to use a generic term, bhakti, and talk about bhakti as if, you know, it is some kind of this thing. But it is a rather ahistorical kind of, you know, abstract notion that we use in order to kind of group a certain type of data together to think of, you know, in some common terms. Prentice also attributes the lack of adequate focus on South Indian texts and traditions to the Orientalist. But I mean, here she goes through, which is very informative. Of course, she is not the first one who raises this question, you know, about the Orientalist construction on Hinduism in general. But what she does is she particularly focuses on how South Indian focus was absent in the Orientalist discussions on Hinduism and so on. I mean, it is true that barring Abu Dubois and prior to him in the 16th century, I suppose, in Dinobili, and barring a few missionaries who on and off, wrote a few things, much of the engagement with South India was with regard to an assumption that they may have made that there is nothing Sanskritic and therefore nothing that we could learn from the South. And they kind of left it. So what happened, the field was left for the anthropologists or quasi-missionary anthropologists who went in and dug up more the popular, you know, the village goddesses and that kind of thing. So you'll find Elmore, Bishop, what's his name, Pope, and others who have done mainly work among these rural communities. And of course, because they were missionaries, they were in touch with local people and they spoke local languages. So they, you know, dug up these things. But the typical Orientalist scholar who is trained in classical Sanskrit and all that simply left that whole field.
Why were they so fascinated by Sanskrit? The whole German philological oppression.
Sorry, why?
The German philological oppression, their fascination with Sanskrit as being the origins of
German. Oh, yes, yes. That was, of course, was there. The romanticization of Sanskrit as though there was no doubt in the 18th, 19th century Indologists' mind that they were basically reconstructing their past, the European past. Yeah, there was no doubt. I mean, William, even Monier Williams is very clear about it. William Jones was very clear. Of course, Max Müller was cautious. He clearly distinguished the attempt of some German scholars identifying Aryan theory with the German, you know, nationalist kind of ideas. So he carefully distinguished himself from that kind of thing. And he said, this is, you know, not the same thing. Of course, by this time, the Nazi thing wasn't anywhere near, but the seeds are, you know, being sown. Eric Fravolna, for instance, one of the best Indian philosophy scholars who translated some of the Indian philosophy Sanskrit texts, Mimamsa texts and so on, had no doubt actually about the European origins of Sanskrit, and what he was doing indeed was actually recovering the lost, you know, past of the Europeans. And I succeeded his son-in-law where I am. So I know him, not him personally, but his son-in-law. Well, he was another character. Of the important contributions made by South Indian regional languages, Tamil Saiva Bhakti texts are very crucial for our understanding of religion in South India. So this is in a way, although it's couched in a kind of a bhakti, people think this is a straightforward bhakti kind of text, but if you read it, she has an axe to grind. She's unpacking the lacuna in the Orientalist discourse. And of course, that's how she comes around digging up the South Indian thing, and you know, what best way to do that other than looking at the Nayanmar, you know, poetry, which is really, you know, rich, not only poetically but also in the emphatic in its emphasis on the local regional traditions and so on. The poetic texts of these Nayanmars are known as Thevaram, and the text that contained their life stories is known as Periya Puranam, a hagiographical text. Thevaram, incidentally, is so popular in South Africa. Now, you must remember, South African Indian community came to South Africa long before India became, you know, independent. So they have no memory of the independent India. They have their memory from the past 19th century thing. So where they were used to singing Thevaram virtually in every occasion, religious, whatever, whether there is a funeral ceremony or a birth ceremony, whatever, Thevaram must be sung. Which surprises the contemporary Tamils when they come to South Africa. They're surprised why Thevaram is sung at a funeral ceremony, because it doesn't happen in Tamil Nadu anymore. It's mainly done in a kind of a ritual, you know, temple ritual context, as part of the devotion to, you know, Shiva and so on, but not certainly in the context of funeral ceremonies. So the Saiva canon as a whole is known as Thirumurai. Murai is actually garland in Tamil. Thiru is like the auspicious name of Shiva. Well, Thiru's generic meaning is like Sri in Sanskrit, like the auspicious one, or the, you know, the divine, if you wish. Nayanmars express their devotion to Shiva through singing his praise and by focusing their praise on the places where Shiva resided. We'll read some of these poems and see, you know, how these localization of these things actually, you know, become important. So she says, praise is the content and pilgrimage is the context of their hymns. In other words, they went from temple to temple singing the praises of Shiva. Now again, within the Tamil country, you know, basically, even that, I think it's basically around Madurai, Tirunelveli, you know, that kind of region. Because at that time, your movement is constrained by the kingdoms. You know, there were Pallavas and there were Cholas. So if you are in the Pallava kingdom, you move around in that kingdom. You know, you just don't cross over. You know, you have to have a passport. Of course, they probably didn't have those passports in those days. They just illegally crossed. So the boundaries were not so protected, so they may have moved around. But generally, there is that highly localization of the tradition. The Tamil poets highlighted the local towns in Tamil land, as important pilgrimage centers, like Madurai, and there are a number of places that we'll see some of the places I can't even, connect, because there are these are really antiquated place names that I don't think exist in that form anymore. So I have no idea what they, we'll see what names come up actually. I can't recognize many of those names. Prentice argues that unlike the idea of anti-structure suggested by Victor Turner, pilgrimage reaffirms social norms. This is a debate about whether pilgrimage, Victor Turner argues that pilgrimage is a place where everything is turned upside down, really. All social norms are turned upside down. The tables are turned upside down. The Brahmins are pushed to the periphery. The low-caste, non-Brahmanical, really ordinary people take the center stage. You see, everything is like turned upside down. And therefore, he argues that it's an instance of a kind of an antinomian, anti-structure kind of, situation. But other anthropologists also suggest that it is only in a controlled context that happens. In other words, in the context of the pilgrimage, the procession, etc., in the context of the ritual and so on, this happens. And therefore, it is because it happens in the context of the ritual, people simply do not question it. And no one is offended, when Brahmins are ill-treated or, called names and whatever, they are not offended. But if you do that outside that, then, you're finished, So therefore, in a way, it is a different way of reinforcing who is in charge, reinforcing the orthodoxy. So the role players are aware of their own, selfhood, their status, etc. So they play them cautiously during that time, and then, of course, they give vent to all their feelings and frustrations and so on, I suppose it's like a, bottleneck, you kind of release the pressure, and societies probably have different ways of putting in place mechanisms as to how you can release the, pressure. Otherwise, it'll explode. So you have to have some, and you rather have these things in an organized fashion rather than, in a highly disorganized kind of way, where it leads to what's happening in Uzbekistan, for instance. Although the Nine Mass hymns use Sanskrit-based mythological narratives as basis for their songs, they localize everything. I think one thing is fairly certain or clear, that these singers or popular poets and so on, although they were singing in regional vernaculars and so on, they are aware of the general circumscription of the boundaries, the cultural boundaries, the religious ethos and so on, through these long exchange of ideas through Brahmanical transmissions and so on. So they are in general aware of the Puranic ideas and so on. But for them, what matters is this local Shiva, this local Parvati and so on. So in that sense, the localization is extremely important process. The poets were not only locating Shiva in temples, but also in open places like fields, forests, tanks. So everything becomes, a reference point for praising Shiva. Not only Shiva who is residing in a particular temple, but the mountain, the hilltops, the rivers, you know, the open spaces, the fields, the forests where Shiva may be wandering around, all of those become part of their, you know, landscape of poetry. So they traversed both the natural place and the social space, designating all types as the home of Shiva. Now here social space meaning the social world in which they are living, the social hierarchies and all of that. For them, Shiva is an embodiment of Tamil land and its culture. There is a, you know, the popular assumption among the Oriental scholars was that Tamil Nadu is, I mean, the South India is basically Shaivism. And they also assume that Shaivism is some kind of corrupted form, some non-Brahmanical sect originally. And of course, there may be truth in that, you know. That's a can of worms that one has to open. And so was the claim about the Vaishnava. I see the analogous to the Buddhist, you know, tradition, they placed actually Buddhism, Vaishnavism, and Shaivism on side by side and called them as non-Brahmanical, non-Hindu, if you wish, you know, in a modified sense, sects. So whether or not they had some history, you know, in the distant past outside the Brahmanical worldview is a part that we don't know really. It's something that is steeped in, you know, a lot of controversy and so on. We don't have internal or external evidence, so that's the problem. But there are indirect ways in which you can point fingers and say this is probably what was going on. So scholars have their views on it. So Oriental scholars probably assumed that if Shaivism was a non-Brahmanical, non-Hindu thing, and if it is predominantly existing in the South, so it is probably not for us to deal with it, you know, because we are not constructing our past through this. So, you know, that's out of the canon. In line with the classical Tamil poetry known as Sankam poetry, or Sangam poetry as is known in Sanskrit, Shaiva poets combine the division of the poetry as interior and exterior. Now, this is an interesting distinction that you see in the oldest surviving poetic texts known as Sankam or Sangham in Sanskrit literature. Now, Sangham literature is predominantly a secular type of literature. There isn't anything religious about this literature. These are basically stories about, you know, love stories, stories about ordinary people and their lives and so on, but very, very beautifully written poetry. This poetry actually reflect, I mean, distinguished from when they talked about a kind of a deep, passionate love songs and so on that affected the internal, inner soul, etc. And the ones that have some kind of a very material, mundane kind of, you know, themes, like themes around the king's royal palace, court, you know, stories and so on, have not much to do with, you know, affecting your passion, emotion, and so on. In a way, the Tamil Nayanmar singers emulated that example, basically. They say they also basically, it's like most of the modern Sanskrit poets, you know, if you look at some of the more recent ones, who effectively emulated the classical poetry of Kalidasa and so on, you know, modeled along those lines. So that becomes like the, you know, type that you, you know, role model that you follow. So in a similar way, the Nayanmar singers emulated the poetry of the Sangam poets. What's interesting here is the word Sangam is not a Tamil word, it's a Sanskrit word. They hardly realized that, actually, because it comes through a Jain, you know, intervention, because by this time, by the second century, Common Era, etc., the Jains are pretty strong in Tamil Nadu. You know, they moved south. When Hindu revival was taking place in the north again, the Jains and the Buddhists moved south. So the southern Indian sort of region becomes more or less kind of strongholds of non-Brahmanical things. So with the Vaishnava and Shaiva thing, that begins to change again, because, you know, these things are part of that transformation there and the religious landscape. So the Sangam poetry was influenced to a certain extent by the Jain monks, and some of the poetry probably was written by the monks, the Jain monks, who probably adopted Tamil as their language. Unlike what we saw in the other cases like Kabir and so on, those who are identified as the Nirguna Bhaktas, if you wish to identify these Nayanmars as a Saguna Bhakti type of group, some have done that, but it's kind of problematic, then in a sense, you could see them belonging to that Saguna group, because like the other Saguna Bhaktas, they also reaffirmed the social order, the conventional social hierarchies, caste orders, and so on, known as, you know, in Sanskrit, Varnashrama Dharma. However, they focused on this idea of sannyasa, renunciation. But their idea of sannyasa or renunciation is not asocial, but it's not like the Brahmanical idea of you leave the entire society and go somewhere else, you know, isolate yourself. But they are a kind of a sannyasins that are in the society, operating within the society, expressing their likes and dislikes and so on, but yet trying to distance themselves from the mundane, you know, realities of their lives and so on. I think there is a long tradition in India of the renunciants, a type of renunciant tradition that is not in line with the Brahmanical renunciation tradition, but rather a kind of a tradition that is in the society. They operated pretty much like a caste group. I mean, you will see them still today in the Dasanami, the Ramanandis. All of these are, you know, renunciants. They don't live up outside in some Himalayan mountains or somewhere, but they are in the cities and towns. They wander around, but they have a group identity. And in the medieval times, they were the ones who actually pretty much ran the economy based on the pilgrimage centers, because they controlled the pilgrimage centers. And in fact, to this day, they do. If you go to Kumbh Mela, etc., you will see them controlling the trade. You know, all these shopkeepers that come and set up shops and so on, they have to get permission from these guys. These are like the local hooligans, you know, say mafia. I mean, they don't have any like order, I mean, like a business house or anything. They're the mafia, you know, they control the whole thing. So they still operate that way. I mean, you will see them with the, you know, I mean, that's why it is so easy to stir up a problem in Ayodhya or anywhere. Because these are the guys that come round with the swords and, you know, swinging everything, and, you know, RSS can stir them up and put them in the thing. I mean, they go kill people.
Is this why there's so much organized crime?
Well, to the I mean, we don't know the extent to which they are linked to these organizations. There are all kinds of other, you know, modern, regular syndicates and so on, you know, all kinds of, like,
the surprise that it's in such a religious place.
Yeah. You see, in India, it is hard to distinguish between all of these, you know, different groups. You know, they are like in and everywhere, and you know, they have like internal lobbies and so on. You know, they use each other. I mean, if you, I mean, you will see this in ordinary cases. Like if a lorry driver carrying cargo from one point A and takes, say, to Calcutta, and before he delivers the goods, he has to go through a, you know, a syndicate, because he has to park his vehicle overnight somewhere, and if he parks it somewhere, by morning nothing will be there. So he has to, you know, pay his whatever it is. And they protect the whole thing. It's very open. There's nothing secret about it. And you go there, park in, and the guy comes up, you give him, and then you go sleep. Nothing will happen to your vehicle. But you go sleep without doing that. Next morning, you won't even see the vehicle there. Or if you see it, it will be empty. You see? And it's very, you know, well organized. Everybody knows. And that's why, you know, understanding, I mean, I don't know if you, that lady that came the other day, the IAS officer from Karnataka on state, she came to lunch last week. I think it was when you cooked. She's actually working on this whole corruption business. And she wants to see how far it can go, you know, its origins and so on. But you can probably take it as far as you can, you know. Land it in the Vedic Samhita somewhere. So, but it is endemic in India, and because it has all kinds of connections. It is so ubiquitous. It just, you know, you can't simply trace it to one place and say this is where it began. It's all over the show. And that's why it is hard to address that kind of issue, because you know, it becomes like a culture. They created a sense of, through their songs, I mean poems, a sense of religious community vis-a-vis the Jainas and the Buddhists. In other words, at the time when they were operating, you know, in that period of the, you know, 500 to 700, you know, before the, Common Era, they did not distinguish themselves vis-a-vis other, like, say, Vaishnava, Shaiva, etc., but they were trying to distinguish themselves from, you know, the Shaivites as opposed to Jaina Buddhists. So that tells us something about who was more influentially operating. So the Jains and the Buddhists were probably more important than probably the neighbors, the Vaishnavas, you know, on the other side. And opposing them is probably much more important than opposing the Vaishnavas. So you don't actually, surprisingly, although they were operating simultaneously, you know, sometimes in the same place, there seems to be no conflict at that time between the Shaivites and the Vaishnavites, not at least in any serious way, you know, except, you know, the Pallavas sometimes oscillated between Vaishnava worship and then Shaiva worship and so on. Cholas did the same thing. So depending on who they patronized, you would have greater, you know, patronage and so on. And then the others received the raw deal. But the real conflict seems to be centered around these other groups. You know, that seems to be the... So they also mention generally the groups known as, you know, just ordinary peasants, Brahmins, queen, reference to the queen, the king, hunter, merchant, potter, all of these as groups are referred to in their poems. But in the sense of a community, when they referred to themselves as a community, they were contrasting themselves with the Jains and the Buddhists and so on. Obviously, temple worship was the key to their poems because that's where they located everything they did. Towards the end of the 13th century, you then see, I think by the end of 9th century, about 10th century, you begin to see the systematization of these ideas as philosophical treatises and so on, commentaries and so on. By certainly the end of 13th century, you have a very clearly articulated Shaiva Siddhanta philosophy, which is coupled with the Nayanmar songs alongside the Kashmir Shaiva Agama ideas. There develops a serious systematic theology called Shaiva Siddhanta theology, which of course is in many ways distanced from the very earthy, mundane kind of things that these guys were talking about. So the Tamil Shaiva Siddhanta defined the sacredness of place by the presence of a guru who, as the embodiment of grace, represented apotheosis of understanding the spiritual significance of human life, the Nayanmars as direct experiences of Shiva, and the temple priests as the leaders who virtually honor Shiva remained important, but they were not, according to Tamil Shaiva Siddhanta, the interpreters who could help people understand the ultimate meanings and obligations of human life. This is the role of the Tamil Shaiva Siddhanta philosophers as gurus. So the poets were basically a kind of a freelance, free, you know, flowing singers. They didn't see themselves as serious interpreters of a religion or a philosophy. They sang. And they evoked deep devotion, sentiment, and so on in people. But they didn't really go about clarifying ideas, you know, philosophical or whatever. They had some philosophical ideas in their songs, but they didn't really worry about clarifying because that wasn't their task. It was simply sufficient for them to sing and encourage people, I mean, devotion in people. His ear adorned with an earring, riding on a bull. So that's a very typical classical image of Shiva, riding on the bull. Crowned by the pure white moon, again. So you can see they are aware of the Sanskritic kind of Puranic ideas and so on. Smeared with ashes from the cremation ground, he stole my heart. This one is Pemman, who resides at Great Piramapuram. Now, I don't know where that is, but it should be somewhere in Tamil Nadu. We don't know what the present name is, but it was, you know, this is probably the old, you know, pre-medieval name Many of the names may have changed. So this one is Pemmon, who recites. Pemmon is this great one, you know. Another word in Tamil that signifies is Periyar. Periyar is kind of more a modern kind of term, the big one. This one is Pemmon who recites at great Piramapuram, where he bestowed grace upon the one of the lotus who worshipped him in days of yore. Now here is an interesting reference to Vishnu. Now see how creatively they subordinate Vishnu to Shiva. The one with lotus, Shiva bestows grace upon Vishnu. You see, there's a lot of mythology about the interaction between Shiva and Vishnu, not with those names, but with local names. And Vishnu participating in the Shaivite kind of things and so on. Like if you see the Madurai Meenakshi temple story, there Shiva as Sundareswara. Sundareswara means the beautiful, you know, the very rarely Shiva is described as the beautiful one. It's Krishna, usually, that's described here. Sundareswara, the lord of beauty. Very odd, isn't it? So he is now quoting Meenakshi. He comes down from the mountains and pitches his camp there, and he's quoting Meenakshi, and then Meenakshi falls in love with him. And then who marries the two? Vishnu. Vishnu hands the... And there is actually... Dennis Hudson is, I think he's very famous with this study, actually. I don't know what he's doing with this study at the moment, but it's a long, lifelong study. He spent the whole life of, I don't think he finished it, but it's kind of an ongoing thing. So he presented, when I was back a long time ago, at Harvard, at the center, he presented one interesting talk where he showed in Madurai Meenakshi temple. You know, you look at these the paintings and the carvings and so on the walls. There's one place where Vishnu and Shiva are standing side by side, and if you see Shiva's image, they are placed like as though, if you see from the top, they are, you know, on a par. They are standing, their heads are on the same level. But if you see the feet, Shiva is standing on a lower pedestal and Vishnu on an upper pedestal. Like, you know, if you are standing on steps, you are on the lower step and Vishnu is on the upper step. So that means Shiva is taller than Vishnu. If he stood, you know, on the same ground, on the same level, he would have been taller. So this guy whoever was trying to depict this thing had some axe to grind here. So he's doing something. So it was very fascinating, actually, how you could actually see these motifs. Let's see some of these things. And yeah, the Lord of the feet that remain upon the earth as its only support, the Lord of the feet that pass through the seven nether worlds, the Lord of the feet that stand as the way of no sorrows, the Lord of the feet that are one with the seven worlds. After the roar of the sea rose up and spread forcefully, then calmed, submerging the whole world, the Lord heard the sound of the Vedas on the Veena. Veena is the the instrument, and resided with love at Venkata. See, ultimately you have to come back to that location where Shiva resides. You can go all over the world and magnify all of these great things and what happened, the cosmic events and so on. Eventually, this is the one who resides at this place. And that's the fascinating thing about these. The Lord is the first being who gracefully intends to destroy all the ensouled beings that abound in races such as celestials, demons, and humans in all the worlds. First among them, the earth that lies at the side of the faultless sea. This Lord resides at Sivapuram, ornamented with fertility and jewels. Now here is another theme that you find in the Sanskrit text. The fame of the one who worships him in this temple will spread throughout the world. And that's the key. The one who worships this Lord in this temple will be the greatest one. Not somewhere else. It's here. Let's look at a few of the nature of categories of the soul. I mean, she organized these interestingly under certain themes. At first, human life is an embryo, like a stew. Then it thickens, forming the brain, black veins, and white bones. Here is the, if you want evolution theory, there is. That join together as one to form a body. So they have their own primitive kind of evolutionary ideas. I mean, evolutionary, probably, the theory of evolution probably didn't start with this guy's 1856 or 57 book. In the world, the body is born and brought up in the care of a woman. In the end, it dies along with the soul. I will not forget your fragrant feet, O Lord. Even if birth occurs again, I shall not go the way of forgetfulness. O husband of Uma at Thiruvarur. You see the play of these things. Uma, the Sanskrit is Sanskritic goddess. But at Thiruvarur, you see how you go far away and then bring it back to, you know, the one who resides in Thiruvarur. May I not forget you, O Lord of Thiruttenkur, O Enkampan. Interesting, isn't it? Forsake shyness, forsake fault, forsake anger of the mind, forsake passions of the household that arise from the intrigue of women. I don't know what that is. With fragrant plaited hair, join with love for the Lord, adorned with bones riding on a bull. Let us reach him at the temple at Ethirkol Party. See, you go again, you see, many of these ideas that they are working with are found in the Sanskritic Puranic stories, and they circumscribe all of them in the context of that particular temple. But I have no comment on this intrigue of women. I don't know what that is. But, inside this house called the body, the heart is the lamp. Pour knowledge that dispels ignorance as the ghee. Fashion the soul as the wick. Take the supreme fire of jnana as the flame. And the vision of the one whose feet have anklets and whose son enjoys the katampu tree will be yours. Again, katampu tree is a local tree. Something like the, you know, these, what is it? These wild berries you get in, you know, in India, the some kind of, you know, the wood apple. Have you heard that? It's elephants in India love it, actually. As kids, when these elephants used to come to circuses and all that, we used to follow these elephants, you know, because we wanted to stamp on. You see, when elephants ate these things and they come out as the same shape, so when you go bang, dah, you know, we used to, as kids, go and stamp on them because it explodes. So we were so excited with the explosion. So, see, you have to live in India to do all these things. Then only you'll be a properly Indian. I cannot express myself at all due to that passion called desire, even though you remain inside me. I am not able to ingest you as I would honey, as I would honey from a bowl. Even though you are my life, you remain hidden. Oh mother, how can I see you? This is about Parvati, his wife. Let's read a few of those other ones. He destroyed the troubles of this birth for me, grown weary in the midst of a sea of afflictions calling me there. It seems he gave me the six nameless gunas. Now that's interesting. What is he referring to? I know in the Vaishnava case what the six auspicious qualities are, but here, the six nameless gunas. In order to penetrate all the worlds of the devas, O our dancer of Kutantai Ki Kottam, surrounded by the Tirthas with leaping waters, the Kaveri, good Yamuna, Ganga Saraswati, golden lotus tank of Madurai. You see, only when it comes to Madurai, he describes it as golden lotus tank. Other tanks, the clear water of the Godavari and Kumari. Kumari is the Kanyakumari in the south. The Lord who is crowned with the intoxicating Kunrai flowers, who stays at Venkatu, where the white elephant came and worshipped, who rescued me, his ignorant servant ensnared by a sea of afflictions, by showing me, saying, this indeed is the path, who terminates all types of daily torments, who is a symbol of purity, wearing this speckled snake, who is always there. I myself saw him at Punturuti. You see, where did you see it? That's the key. You see, what's important in these local Sthala Puranas, if you know what you call them, is the theme is always where Shiva has manifested himself. And that's the key. It's not so much where else he was, but this is where he manifests, and that becomes the key. I mean, in fact, if you look at the Madurai temple mythology, the Sthala Puran, Madurai becomes the most important sacred space. There's a particular way in which they describe the black mountains and all of those hills, and surrounded by those things, the valleys and so on. There's a big narrative about this, relocating the sacred space. Of course, you can now, today, by the diaspora community, you can relocate the sacred space in Norway. The rivers of Norway become the sacred, Tirthas.
Was there ever any competition between different localities for importance?
Well, they would kind of play. I mean, it's not, what they do is when they move to another place, that becomes the key. So they kind of switch their loyalties, because they are singing to that Shiva. I mean, this actually is a very unique common theme in the, I don't know whether it is generic to the South Indian way of thinking. You don't see this in North India. Even in the case of Vaishnava, Sri Vaishnava tradition, you will find this. Ramanuja had to ask permission to go to from Srirangam to Kanchipuram. He had to ask Ranganatha permission to go to Varadaraja. You see, on the one hand, it is Vishnu in both places. But it isn't actually, in reality, Vishnu. It is Ranganatha and it is Varadaraja. So he is leaving Ranganatha to go to... So he has to seek permission from this guy to go to that guy. And that's how important it is. Of course, this gets played out in various other political and social power relations. You know, so there are these undercurrents there. You know, who controls these temples, and you know, basically, effectively, what it really was. You know, this is where history becomes important in understanding this. He was actually asking the head of the temple permission to go and see the other temple. Basically, that's all it was. But the hagiography, the historical memory of the community, shapes it in a different way and presents it as if he is asking the permission of the deity. You see, there is hardly any distinction between the deity and the hierarchy of the temple.
It's amazing, I never heard that before, because in modern sort of temples you get the very similar thing. The temple doesn't have a break. I thought that sort of slow sort of struggle to that. I'm surprised.
No, the temple hierarchies are very, very powerful. Who controls the temple? You see, at the end of the day, the rajas, the maharajas, the kings, the cholas and the pallavas and so on, gave lands to these temples for maintenance. And the priest invariably controlled those vast amount of lands. He received taxes. He collected taxes and he was exempt from taxes. And this is actually what is at the bottom of Tirupati temple's dominance today. Why is it that the high priest of Tirupati temple is so powerful? Because of the money. Why is it that Kanchi Kamakoti, that Shankaracharya's arrest, was so controversial? On a daily basis, that temple where he is located raises 200 something like 200 million rupees income. Now you can multiply by about 10 or 50, 100 times at Tirupati.
I heard that the reason that white people are not allowed in Jagannath Puri temple is because there are different groups inside who take around, they have like a set region when people come from that region and they're their people and they show them around, they get money from them. They couldn't agree internally that they would show the white people.
No, the white people thing is, I think it's generally, it's something to do with what is called in South Achara. Achara meaning not tradition in that sophisticated scholarly sense. It simply means untouchability.
But even Indians born outside India know that as
well. Well, but that is a more recent modern phenomenon. It's this whole fear about, you know, who are these foreigners coming in. You see, in temples, I suppose in many religious places, your body language gives up. People know who you are, even without you. I mean, even if you are a white person, they will tell whether you are, you know, Hindu, you know, for a long time practicing Hinduism and so on or not. Your body language gives up. They know. So immediately they spot you and they say, please, you know, move. And you better do it without questions, you know, because they know.
I have several black friends who go to temples.
Hmm. I mean, in South India, you see, it's very easy for them to find, even if they fail to notice your body, you know, postures and so on. When you eventually get to the, you know, entrance, they ask you, you know, yeah, your, you know, what is it, gotra. What's your gotra? Now, who would know that gotra if you're living, you know, what's your gotra?
I've heard it before.
Yeah, you see? So naturally, you will have difficulty. Of course, if the priest, of course, if he is sympathetic, he'll make up a gotra for him. All you need to do is to give him the family deity name. That's all. Then he'll make up a story. He'll make up a gotra and so on. There are links how to, you know, it's like how they cooked up these lineages of kings in the olden days, you know, whether you belong to the Lonar dynasty or Solar dynasty. You know, in South India, they had no such tradition. You know, the Aryan kings had those traditions. So in South India, when the Brahmanical, you know, order started impinging, so these Brahmin priests gradually introduced that idea, and they would trace this guy, this Pandyan king or Chola king, who, you know, this guy is some, you know, some Velala or whatever he was. You know, he wasn't even a Kshatriya in that sense, you know, because in much of South India, kings were not necessary. You see, this whole notion of Kshatriya, you can't, you know, attach to the South Indian case because it gets problematic. Because they became, in many cases, these were usurpers of, you know, power. You know, if you are the strongest guy, you know, defeat the other guy, you become the king. And then when you become the king, then the priest will automatically come and then he will, you know, trace the dynastic lineage, you know, for about 10 generations, and then say after that, you know, it's the sun, you know, or the moon, whoever. So it's, you know, it's the same thing. So the lineage is very important in that sense. Of course, it's important not only for the kings, but also for the priests. Priests themselves would trace their lineages all the way back to the Vedic rishis. They have to do that. Even though the Agama texts, you know, were understood by themselves as non-Vedic, you know, outside Vedic things, they would claim the lineage in such a way by attaching the lineage through the rishis, you know, Bharadwaja, etc., go all the way up to, you know, through Narada. Narada links everybody. And then after that, you can jump to right up to Vishnu, straight. So, you see. The Pancharatrins traced directly to Vishnu, but the Vaikhanasas traced them to the Vedic lineage, the Rishi lineage. So they consider themselves more orthodox than the Pancharatrins. Pancharatrins didn't have the lineage, so they said Vishnu is our forefather. So if you, it's like Gandhi calling everybody Harijan, you know. Then Ambedkar getting up and saying, who the hell are you? I think I must put this one off here. What do I do here? I don't know. You see,